This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Friday is here again, and that means it's time for our weekly news review. We have lots to discuss this week, including the Miami University faculty vote to unionize and the latest on Kroger's proposed acquisition of Albertsons. But we're going to start by taking a look at the results from Kentucky's primary election. Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron won the Republican nomination, and Democratic Governor Andy Beshear handily beat his primary opponents, too. Joining me now to talk about their successful campaigns and other important primary results are Kentucky Lantern political reporter McKenna Horsley. Welcome back, McKenna.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kentucky Lantern reporter Liam Niemeyer. Thanks for being here, Liam.
Good to be here.
And Louisville Public Media reporter Roberto Roldan. Welcome, Roberto.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're glad to have you all here. McKenna, let's start with you. As I mentioned, Attorney General Daniel Cameron won the Republican primary, which wasn't a total surprise, but he won by so much. Was that surprising?
I think it definitely shows how strong his candidacy was. He received about 48% of the votes in that primary. And there's a bit of a gap between him and the second place candidate, which was Agriculture Commissioner Ryan Quarles. There's some speculation that Quarles could be a good potential running mate for Cameron in the general election, given that he had that strong second place finish. But earlier today, Cameron did say he's still mulling that decision over.
Well, and Liam, former Ambassador Kelly Craft spent a lot of money but came in third. Did that surprise you? Did it hurt her somehow that she was so self-funded?
Yeah, there was definitely, some conversation about that on social media regarding, why Kraft's campaign didn't resonate as much in terms of whether, let's say Kentuckians, say they didn't like a candidate that was perceived to have been, buying a nomination for the Republican nomination for governor. There's been some analysis done in terms of the amount of money that Kraft's campaign has spent per vote compared to other campaigns. And the disparity is large. I think it's something around Kraft's campaign spent something around a little more than $180 per vote, on the campaign versus Cameron's campaign. I think it per vote, the money spent, I think, is a little under $10. So the disparity there is definitely large.
Wow. And Roberto, former President Trump endorsed Attorney General Daniel Cameron early on. Do you have any thoughts about how important that Trump endorsement was for him?
I think it's still seen I think President Donald Trump is still seen as having a lot of sway among Republican voters, particularly among those who might be motivated enough to go out to a primary. Typically, primaries have relatively low voter turnout, so you get the folks who really are the most energized to want to participate in their own party's politics. So I think it probably did have a pretty big effect on the race.
What do you think, McKenna?
Well, I do think that the Trump endorsement did play a factor here. But one thing that I heard from Stephen Voss, who's a political science professor at the University of Kentucky, is that Kentucky Trump voters really had three choices in the primary. They had someone who was endorsed by Trump and Daniel Cameron. And they also had somebody who emulated some of Trump's cultural policies that he had in Kelly Craft. And then in Eric Dieters, who's a attorney from Northern Kentucky, they had somebody who captured Trump's style on the campaign trail. So that could have divided the vote there as well in the primary.
Well, and McKenna, as I mentioned, Democratic Governor Andy Beshear, he also had primary challengers, but he won by quite a bit. He's rated as one of the most popular governors in the United States. How much could that help him in the general election?
I think with his high approval rating, and I believe that poll from Morning Consult has him at 63% approval rating, and with him getting 91% of the vote in his primary, that kind of shows how he has a very popular image with Kentuckians that really he cultivated during the pandemic. He had weekly press conferences where he was in people's homes talking to them while they were worrying about some kind of outside stressor and seeing kind of an unforeseen circumstances that they've never seen before. And it kind of shows how his leadership during that time is impacting Kentuckians now.
Well, and then also during these terrible natural disasters that Kentucky has had, that is that a factor too for him, McKenna?
Yes, I do think that's a factor as well, because he was pretty quick to get on the ground in both of those cases in Western and Eastern Kentucky. And he has since gone to both regions and continued to talk about rebuilding in both of those regions as well. And this weekend, he'll be visiting a lot of those same areas as well on his bus tour for his campaign.
Liam, how nasty do you think this governor's race could get between Democratic Governor Andy Beshear and Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron?
Well, at the very least, it's going to be an expensive one. The Democratic Governors Association, which is backing Beshear's campaign, is putting out an ad buy for next week. And Andy Beshear has already come out with an ad. I think the Democratic Governors Association ad buy was something around $360,000. And the Beshear buy for his first ad of the general campaign, a little over $500,000. And we're talking just days after the primary, which, according to Medium buying, when Beshear was running for governor in 2019, when he was attorney general, he didn't go up on TV until, I believe, in August, heading into that general election campaign. So it's going to be very expensive. And, I imagine that the rhetoric is going to get pretty heated. I was covering Daniel Cameron as watch party when he won the primary on Tuesday. And during his victory speech, he highlighted a lot of potential lines of attack that, I expect is going to be common themes in the general campaign, including such as attacking Beshear over what he sees as taking credit for, good news regarding the economy and jobs that he says that are, actually a part of actions taken by the Republican-dominated Kentucky legislature. And then also, attacks regarding gender-affirming care for transgender youth. So at the very least, there's potentially going to be a lot of money coming this way. And, of course, yeah, the rhetoric is, I imagine, going to get heated as well.
Do you have a sense, maybe either Liam or McKenna, I don't know which of you have covered more of this, what Governor Beshear's argument's going to be in these ads? Why? I mean, Kentucky has more registered Republican voters now than registered Democratic voters, if I'm remembering that correctly. So, that's a data point that doesn't work in the governor's favor. What do you think he's going to be trying to kind of sell voters in terms of trying to get a second term?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he will likely lay off some of the attacks that you're going to see from the Democratic Governors Association and some of the PACs that are supporting him. But it looks like overall his message will be talking about unity of Kentuckians, which kind of harkens back to some of that messaging that he really had during the pandemic and those natural disasters. And it kind of shows, it's kind of leaning into his style of governing that he's kind of cultivated over these past 4 years, and he's bringing it into his reelection campaign.
Liam, you mentioned this national money coming into Governor Beshear's campaign already. Do you think there's going to be national money and national attention for both these candidates' campaigns?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, national pundits are sort of looking at this Kentucky governor's race as a kind of a precursor to the 2024 presidential election in terms of, what conservative Trump voters are looking for in the candidate. There is some commentary about that in terms of who's going to win in the GOP primary for governor in Kentucky. There's only a few major governor's races, happening across the country. I think a couple others are, Mississippi and Louisiana. But this is the only race where in a red state where there's a Democratic incumbent. So there's going to be a lot of money poured into this race, I imagine. And a lot of attention in part because there's, you know, not, you know, an off year election, which Kentucky's one of the few states that still has off year elections for statewide races. You know, there's just in part, there's not a lot of races going on. And, you know, this is one of the few major ones.
Well, speaking of statewide races, Roberto, I want to talk to you about the Secretary of State race. Incumbent Michael Adams, a Republican, had two opponents in the primary. Tell us about those opponents. What were the big issues in this race?
Yeah, his opponents were Stephen Nipper and Alan Maracle. And essentially, the way that Adams tried to frame the race and really the way that the race played out was, you know, Adams has been a bit of an enigma in the Republican Party. If you look at it through the lens of national politics, on one hand, he's placated the Republican base by, you know, pushing the General Assembly to adopt photo ID requirements ahead of the 2020 election. But then on the other hand, during the pandemic, he worked with Democratic Governor Andy Beshear to implement no excuse vote by mail and expand early in-person voting. His whole sort of philosophy as Secretary of State has been one of making it easier to vote and harder to cheat is what he says. And, you know, in line with that, one of the things that he said is that he thinks that Kentucky elections are very secure. He thinks the elections that Kentucky had in 2020 were some of the most secure that they've ever had. So on the other hand, you had his opponent, Stephen Nipper, who was really his main opponent. And he had previously run for Secretary of State, and he fully embraced the conspiracies that sprung up out of the 2020 presidential election, you know, things like widespread voter fraud and Democrats winning elections. He toured the state with Senator Adrian Southworth, where they spread allegations that, you know, every election since Ronald Reagan's in 1980 was rigged, which conveniently didn't include Trump's 2016 win. But Nipper was also endorsed by one of the most probably well-known election conspiracy theorists, my Pillow CEO, Mike Lindell. And so it really set up this framing of the Secretary of State's race, where you had Michael Adams on one hand, who was claiming that elections were secure in the state of Kentucky, and then really election denialists on the other hand.
So there were pretty high stakes in that race. Michael Adams won and will be the Republican candidate in November. How did he characterize the importance of that win?
Yeah, I spoke with him on Monday, the day before primary election day. And essentially, the way that he framed it is, you know, it was an opportunity, if Republican voters did choose him, it was an opportunity for them to kind of reject misinformation, to reject these conspiracy theories and kind of say in his mind that, you know, we are independent thinkers here in the state of Kentucky and that we aren't going to be influenced by some of these national right-wing media figures with their theories about what happened in 2020 and what continues to happen with the elections. But on the other hand, I think he was very frank about the fact that if he did lose, he felt as though basically every gain that he had made in terms of voter access was going to be undone, if for no other reason than the Republican-dominated General Assembly was going to see him get primaried and lose to folks who, you know, were election denialists and would essentially try to undo the things that they had already put in place in terms of expanded in-person voting, because they themselves wouldn't want to be primaried from the right.
Well, you talked about this election denialism. There was also some bashing of this national ERIC system as part of this campaign, as I understand it. Can you explain what this national ERIC system is and the role it played in this campaign?
Yeah, so ERIC is a bipartisan organization made up and funded by secretaries of states or election administrators throughout the country. Essentially, it was created as something to promote election integrity. The whole point was that states would essentially share information about who's on their voter rolls. When someone moves from one state to another and registers to vote in another state, the state where they moved from could be notified, hey, this person registered to vote outside the state, and then they could remove them from the voter rolls. Essentially, it was created to help states clean up their voter rolls. You know, obviously, Secretary of State Michael Adams is a Republican, said that he supported this. But there's been in recent weeks some reporting from national right-wing media outlets that this system is somehow funded by George Soros, which is quite a popular villain for the right. And you've seen states like Virginia most recently move to remove the state from the system. And so you had two opponents of Secretary of State Mike Adams who were saying, you know, they want to get out of the system. That would be one of the things that they would do if they were elected. And then you had Secretary of State Michael Adams, who essentially had been refusing pressure over recent months to remove Kentucky from the system, and essentially said that, you know, he would reevaluate Kentucky's participation after the election, but that he wasn't going to make that decision now and make it appear as though it's something political to try to earn votes. He wanted to, in his words, have an objective look after the election.
Interesting. So Republican incumbent Secretary of State Michael Adams won his primary. Who will he be facing in the fall?
Yes. So he has a Democratic challenger, Charles Buddy Wheatley. Wheatley is a former state representative and a fire department chief from Covington. He was unopposed in the primary, and so there was no Democratic primary on the ballot for that office on Tuesday. Campaign finance data shows he's so far raised less than $100,000. So that could be because he was unopposed in the primary. But at this point, I think it's really hard to tell. Obviously, the Secretary of State will have the benefit of incumbency, which sometimes is can be pretty big. But I think Wheatley does have some name recognition being a former state representative. So we'll just have to see how that plays out.
McKenna, Leon was talking about how we've got this off-year election with the governor's race and these other statewide offices. How much will turnout matter in November?
Turnout will definitely matter. And typically, we see a higher turnout in a general election than you do in a primary. I believe the final unofficial turnout that we're kind of seeing this week is around 14%, which is a bit higher than what Michael Adams had originally projected last week. And that was 10%, which is very low for a primary in Kentucky. I think the last general election, we saw about 40% in 2019. So you'll see some, as time goes on, you'll see more people vote in a general election. Also, Kentucky has closed primaries. So there was a section of voters who are registered independent that didn't make a choice on Tuesday. So coming in November, we'll see them make a choice as well.
Sure, I guess both. All the candidates will be trying to win over those voters for sure. McKenna, how big a role do you think culture wars could play in the governor's race especially?
I think we've already seen kind of a culture war message come out of the Republican primary so far. We did see a lot of, especially in Kelly Craft's campaign, we did see a lot of targeting of woke ideologies, such as issues of transgender affirming care for youth, which is something we also saw in the legislative session this season. So going into a general election, we'll probably see that on both sides, their takes on that issue. And also we'll probably also see another kind of cultural topic in the Breonna Taylor case that Daniel Cameron's expected to get some renewed questions about those things as time moves on.
Well, I've been talking with Kentucky Lantern political reporter McKenna Horsley, Kentucky Lantern reporter Liam Niemeyer, and Louisville Public Media reporter Roberto Roldan. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, Miami University faculty members are unionizing. We'll hear why. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Miami University faculty members say they want to see changes from the administration, and they voted to unionize. Joining me now to talk about the vote and the months of organizing behind it are Cincinnati Inquirer education reporter Madeline Mitchell. Welcome back, Madeline.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
And WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thanks for being here, Zach.
Good to be here.
Madeline, tenured and tenure-track faculty members had a two-week-long mail-in election to decide whether to form a union. Tell us what happened there.
So about a year ago, a little over a year ago, Kathy Wagner, she's an English professor, and she was one of the leaders who started this movement. But I think it actually started happening, this idea, well before then. In 2020, there were at least 150 faculty members that were laid off, like adjunct professors. And when that happens, you know, it's not just those people that were laid off that it impacts. It's all of the other faculty who then have to take on more classes to accommodate for that, right? So I think teachers at Miami have been fed up ever since then. And it showed this week when they counted those tallies.
Zach, how big was the win?
It was a pretty sizable win. 65% of the people that voted in this election voted in favor of the union. They only needed just over half to secure the win. So out of, 800 eligible faculty, not all of them voted, but it was 450 votes for the union and 241 votes against the union. So 65%, pretty strong. That's something that members of this union, representatives from this union were really, they weren't surprised by it, because every time that I had talked to them about this, they were confident that faculty really supported this union. So it was definitely a strong showing and a strong, clear message from the people involved here that this is something that they had wanted and wanted for a long time.
And Zach, how did the group's chair characterize the win?
Well, they said it was a strong message at the end of the day. Like Madeline said before this, that the pandemic had really changed things for them. They had been talking about a union for, at least a couple years before the pandemic. But, once, over 100 teachers had been let go, or 100 professors had been let go during the pandemic, they knew it was time to start organizing. And that's something that they knew they had to get behind to get this done.
Madeline, who all will be covered by the union now since this vote, and how big a deal is this for Miami historically?
So Miami has never had a union for its faculty. This is a very big deal, and they're joining the majority of Ohio Public University faculty do have unions at most of the other universities. I believe Ohio State and Ohio University are now maybe the only two, or there might be one other that doesn't have a union, but this is a very big deal for Miami, and there's over 800 faculty that will be covered, so that's a pretty big chunk of people that are even just living and working in that area, right? I mean, the Miami University is one of the biggest employers over in Butler County. So this is a very big deal. I'm interested to see, though, how long it's going to take to actually see any changes, because these bargaining agreements can take a year or more. So we might not really see the impact that this does have for many months.
Hmm. Zach, what was the administration's reaction to this vote?
Well, their reaction, not necessarily surprising. They had come out and said before this, when the union had first started organizing, that they didn't support this. We see this every time when employees want to unionize. The employer, almost all the time says they don't support it. They want to work with their employees on an individual basis instead of collectively. So they had always been against the union, but, they supported the faculty's right to hold this election, to have this vote, and express, what they felt, what they wanted. So they said, they were willing to bargain in good faith. But then, of course, that message said could take up to a year. So we'll see how things go after this point. Once they get certified in June, we'll see how negotiations go. If things go well, it could be, or if things, move smoothly, it could, take less than a year. But, sometimes these union contracts can take years, multiple years at some time. So this is something that could be an ongoing thing, and it could definitely change or accelerate because more employees at Miami University could be unionizing soon. The librarians are actually going to be holding an election. It's actually underway right now. Results will be coming in this summer. So we'll see if that has any effect on the negotiations as well.
Interesting. Madeline, what are the organizers' goals? What I know that they're just at the very beginning of stages of this, but what have they said about the changes they'd like to see in working conditions or pay or whatever when it comes to Miami?
I think a big part of this is, like we had mentioned, because of the pandemic and when some faculty were let go, you know, their course loads became really challenging for some of these professors. So I think that's top of mind for a lot of these professors that are in the union. They want to make sure that they're protected so that they don't have an unbearable workload. And that's not fair to students either. So it's also about protecting those students and making sure they're getting, you know, a top-notch education that they're paying for and having professors available to them who are clear-headed, you know, not stressed out to the point where they can't give their best selves to their students. I know that's definitely top of mind. And then also just, you know, having autonomy and making sure that they can do all the things that they want to do in their classes, having that kind of rapport with upper administrators to get the resources that they need.
How much, Zach, have you heard much in terms of issues like pay equity and tenure protections? Are some of those things part of the wish list? I shouldn't say wish list, but part of what the union's seeking also?
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. And it's mostly just a seat at the table, right? When we look at what's happening at universities right now, they just want to have a voice, especially when it comes down to curriculum. And then, of course, you know, job security, as we talked about, you know, all those employees that were let go a few years ago. You know, now that you have a bargaining voice, you know, you have a little more control over that when you're negotiating with an employer, when they can, you know, hang things over your head like your health care that is tied to your employment. You know, all the control is in Miami's administration. I mean, previously. Now, you know, the union has a little bit more control. They have a little more of a voice. You know, the organizers told me that, you know, now we don't have to work at the whims of the university. We have a say in things. And I think the curriculum thing is very important, especially with, you know, the news this week from Senate Bill 83 and kind of how, you know, the state government kind of wants to take control of what's going to be going on in college classrooms in the future. They definitely want to highlight that, highlight the curriculum control, have control over what is being talked about in the classroom.
Madeline, you had mentioned, I think, that this union still must be certified. Talk to us about that process. When is that expected to happen?
Right. So what happened this week, I know it's confusing for some folks. This week, they tallied the votes. So that was the big news, is that we know that the majority of professors who voted, they want this union to happen, 65% of them. So that's not official until June 8th. That is when the State Employment Labor Relations Board will meet for a business meeting. And at that time, they'll certify the votes, certify the union. So nothing can happen bargaining-wise until after they're certified on June 8th.
And Zach, you mentioned that there's this other vote that's in progress with the librarians. Do you know how many people that involves? Could this add a lot, or is that a much smaller group than the faculty group that just voted?
So this is definitely a smaller group. This is essentially just the librarians that work at the university. So this is smaller than the union that was, you know, just voted on previously. But, you know, 40% of the faculty at Miami University are not represented in this current union. Mm. So they see this, the librarians, as just another step at getting more employees at the university a part of a union, having some representation. You know, that 40%, that's still a big chunk. It seems like, you know, tenure track faculty, that still makes up a good chunk, but they want to use this victory as a way to kind of keep the ball rolling, keep adding unions, and eventually, you know, get almost every full-time faculty, maybe even some part-time faculty a part of a union. So this is one big step for them, but they just see this as the first step.
And that 40%, that obviously would include the librarians because they've got their own vote going on. But what other kinds of positions make up that 40%?
It's like researchers, you know, employees within like the school itself. That's like people that work within the library, people who might be, you know, visiting professors or part-time professors, or just ones that aren't considered tenured. So that could just be somebody that's been there for a couple of years. So that makes up a pretty diverse group of employees there. So, you know, with the Employee Relations Board, these things have to be approved by them. So when you have all these different types of faculty there, sometimes you have to make almost individual unions for each kind of position at the university. So we don't necessarily know how that's going to eventually play out. If they can have, you know, another union that kind of encompasses all of them, we'll see how that goes. But yeah, for right now, it seems like they're going to have specific unions for each faculty. So librarians right now, and we don't necessarily know what's going to be coming next.
Madeline, what will you be watching for in this whole thing?
Well, something that we just mentioned a few minutes ago with Senate Bill 83, and we've got some other things in the works. I'm really interested to see how that impacts how this bargaining will go and, you know, what kind of state mandated roadblocks that they might run into over the next year or so. You know, these professors are talking about that they want more of a say with their curriculum and they want to have a voice at the table. That could get squashed depending on what happens in the House.
Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer education reporter Madeline Mitchell and WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, could Kroger's acquisition of Albertsons create the national launch of a new media empire? We'll talk about it. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. My next guest has been closely following Kroger's proposed acquisition of Albertsons, and he reports that while there's been lots of coverage of the pros and cons of the deal when it comes to corporate efficiencies and competition in the grocery business, there's another facet of the deal that hasn't gotten much attention. Joining me now to talk about that and some of his other recent reporting is WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Lucy.
Explain where Kroger's proposed acquisition of Albertsons stands now and why Kroger executives say it's such a good idea.
Well, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is reviewing the proposed merger and has not decided whether to intervene to try to block it or to approve it. And so Kroger is doing its best to drum up support by the deal by emphasizing how it could save consumers money, the cost savings they achieve by merging with Albertsons stores will allow them to reduce costs, boost wages, and lower prices, in their opinion.
And critics have a very different perspective on the whole thing. What are they saying?
They say it will enrich shareholders, eliminate jobs, and give Kroger enough market power to squeeze concessions out of suppliers. They say it would be anti-competitive.
Okay. You reported there's a whole other way to look at this deal, though. What's that?
Well, I talked to an analyst who said that one of the big reasons that he thinks Kroger wants to do this deal is this new field of retail media. And Kroger has talked about this to analysts and to Wall Street for several years now. And they claim that they generated $1 billion in operating profit last year from this ability of theirs to know which customers will buy which products. And then they share that information with advertisers, and then they target ads to, you know, specific consumers. And it's really a growing industry now. A lot of retail outlets are using their data to help advertisers find the consumers who are most likely to buy their products. Rodney McMullen said this will be a $55 billion industry across all retailers by 2024. And he thinks that it could be a big gain for Kroger in the years ahead. What this analyst told me is that the merger really enhances Kroger's ability to make money in this field because they pick up about 25 million new households by acquiring Albertsons stores. And that allows them to go from 40% of the population to 70%. And so he thinks it's really a game changer for what is likely the most profitable segment that Kroger operates in right now.
So that's what I want to make sure I understand. Is that what Kroger Precision Marketing is?
That's Kroger. Yeah, it's It refers to, you know, the 84-51, the way they analyze data from loyalty cards, from shopper data.
Company formerly known as Dunnhumby.
Yes, that's right. And it also refers to Kroger Precision Marketing, which is essentially the ad agency that Kroger uses to connect consumers to the advertisers who want to sell to them. Now, Kroger stresses that they do not reveal personal information about shopper. What they give the advertisers is anonymized data, they say. And so they allow these advertisers to place ads either through Kroger apps or in the store or online. As you know, people are increasingly ordering their groceries online. They might see an ad for, you know, a P&G product, for example, if their data says the person who is now placing an order, might be receptive to a P&G offer. And so those advertisers might try to reach them with a coupon. They might just try to reach them with an ad touting the effectiveness of their product. But in the meantime, Kroger makes money off of connecting those two interested parties.
So this is different from the coupons I get from Kroger that are exactly what I need, which is both really convenient and kind of creepy. This sounds like it goes beyond that.
Well, it is. I think Kroger is doing it a lot for their own products, but they're also making this service available to consumer product companies. So if you've ever gotten a coupon for Tide detergent, that probably was a deal brokered by Kroger Precision Marketing.
Hmm. So who would Kroger's biggest competitors in this realm be if they become an even bigger player in this kind of media side of things?
Well, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Walmart, they're all in this business. And I'm not really sure how big Kroger is in comparison to those, but I do know that Kroger ranks pretty high in a comparison of retail companies that are offering this service. Kroger and Amazon are at the top of the list of retail media networks in terms of their effectiveness, according to a trade group called the Path to Purchase Institute. It's a for-profit trade group that's based in Chicago. And it rates different companies on their ability to target consumers and give advertisers a return on investment. And so Kroger ranks up there with Amazon in their effectiveness. Albertsons, by contrast, ranks at the bottom of the list of 13 retailers. So that is another area where Kroger might be able to gain some additional revenue, additional profits by improving Albertson's way of targeting consumers on behalf of advertisers.
How will federal regulators be taking this into consideration, or will they? Will they be considering this media side of things?
Yeah, I think they will be looking at this media side of things, because during the Senate hearing on antitrust issues related to Kroger, there were several lawmakers who commented on this, who questioned how Kroger uses data and how Albertsons use data and how that might change if these two companies were combined. The Wall Street Journal has signaled that this is one of the issues the FTC is looking at. But ultimately, what a lot of analysts believe is that this deal is going to come down to the cities where Kroger competes. And there is overlap between Albertsons and Kroger, and it'll be a much more like traditional way of looking at it for the FTC, as opposed to getting into some of these side issues, like the size of the dividend that Albertsons paid its shareholders, or whether privacy will be impacted by the merger, and whether wages will be impacted by the merger. I think some of the most recent reports issued and opinions issued on this seem to indicate that they're going to concentrate on the market concentration of these two companies, specifically in the cities where there's a lot of overlap.
I see. And are analysts expecting this deal to go through? What's next with this?
I mean, there are analysts on both sides of the issue. There are some analysts who say that based on trading patterns, investors don't seem convinced that the deal will go through. And so they think that's a sign that that it will be blocked by the FTC. But, there are also analysts like the one I talked to for this story who said that, this person thinks that it ultimately will come down to this comparison of competition in the store in the cities where there's a lot of Albertsons and Kroger stores. And he thinks Kroger and Albertsons will be able to convince the FTC that it will not be anti-competitive because they're going to be able to find buyers who will keep the stores viable after they're spun off. So the way Kroger approached this with the FTC is we'll make sure that this doesn't impact consumers by selling off stores where we have the highest market share. And in the past, that has come back to haunt the FTC because Albertsons, when it bought Safeway, it let go of some stores that ultimately closed because they weren't able to compete against the new Albertsons Safeway chain. And I think what Kroger is going to try to convince the FTC of is that that the stores they sell off will remain in business, will remain viable competitors against this combined Kroger-Albertsons entity.
Well, I know we can count on you to stay on top of that. I want to talk to you about another story that you reported recently. We've talked before on this show about the city of Cincinnati's lawsuit against Vinebrook Homes. Remind us, first of all, what Vinebrook owns, how big it is, what is Vinebrook Homes, and then what the city is alleging in that suit.
Vinebrook Homes owns about 3,300 rental properties in Greater Cincinnati, mostly single-family homes, and they're an institutional investor. They're a publicly traded company that uses the money that they get from the from those public markets to acquire lots of homes all over the country. Ohio is one of their favorite markets, and Cincinnati is the largest market for Vinebrook Homes. And what the city alleged in a January lawsuit is that Vinebrook engages in illegal and predatory landlord practices, and they're asking the court to appoint a receiver to take control of more than 900 Vinebrook rental properties inside city limits until some of their concerns are resolved. And Vinebrook had a chance to respond to those allegations in detail at the end of April. In a court filing, they said that the city's lawsuit is a broad overreach of government authority and an attempt to shake it down for money. Basically, they're saying that the city is trying to make a scapegoat out of it for a lot of the problems that it says the city are to blame for.
Tell us more about that, because I saw that line in your story that Vinebrook says the city is, quote, essentially using Vinebrook as a scapegoat, end quote. Yeah. In what way?
It says they're trying to divert responsibility. Here's how they said it in their response to the lawsuit. Diverting responsibility for potential issues that may equally arise from the city's own failures to generate economic growth, improve schools, and support law enforcement to reduce crime.
Interesting. You had a lawyer quoted in your story that used the phrase a cornered animal. Tell us what that was about.
Well, we were talking about how the Vinebrook has come out aggressively now in the city's lawsuit and argued pretty forcefully that this claim has no merit and cited various reasons why. And then this attorney, Rick de Blasius, he is suing them in a proposed class action lawsuit over a $10 monthly fee that appears in Vinebrook leases. And this is a fee that the company collects to help it with maintenance of properties. De Blasius says this is illegal in Ohio, and he's seeking recovery of that fund and damages on behalf of everybody with a Vinebrook lease that has to pay that fee. And he's been opposed pretty vigorously as well by Vinebrook in his class action lawsuit. There's a hearing coming up later this month where Vinebrook will argue that the case should be dismissed. And you know, what he was saying is that Vinebrook is escalating its legal attacks against people it perceives as attacking it. In his case, he's got two law firms now he's opposing on the Vinebrook case. And in the city's case, there's a third law firm. So two of Cincinnati's biggest law firms, Keating, Muthing, and Kleecap, and the Taft Law Firm, are both now arguing on behalf of Vinebrook. And that's a relatively new development. So what de Blasius is claiming is that, Vinebrook is not looking to shake hands anymore. They're looking to self-preservation, in his words.
They've lawyered up in a big way, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, and we don't have a whole lot of time left, but there was a previous city lawsuit that ended with a settlement. How do we get from there to where we are now?
Well, the current lawsuit that the city has, the one filed in January, one of its allegations is that Vinebrook reneged on its settlement. The city sued them in 2021 for failing to pay water bills and a series of code violations that it failed to cure. And it agreed in that settlement to take care of those code violations within 45 days and then bring the city current on water bills. And they're saying that it has continued the code violations. And that's one of the reasons they're seeking a receiver to take control of the properties.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more detail in your report on WCPO.com. I would encourage our listeners to check it out. I've been talking with WCPO 9i team reporter Dan Monk. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Derek Smith. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Happy Friday, and I hope you have a great weekend.